Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is TalkArt.
Welcome to TalkArt.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling analytical and inquisitive because our guest makes the most amazing films. They're sort of mixing the documentary genre, in a sense, with kind of fine art filmmaking. And they are very masterful in their construction. And I think today's guest is one of the most intelligent friends that I have.
Agreed.
Because the way he deconstructs popular culture and the way that society is constructed, and also the way that we build people up within the kind of public realm.
Talk art.
No, not talk art, my love. Even though you do have a very big ego, but that's a different thing. No, but the way that, you know, society and the media like to hype things up and then often without very critical analysis. And
well,
then
it's the British way of putting someone on the pedestal and then knocking them off.
Exactly. But more recently, we've had a lot of like fallen heroes from the past.
Awesome grace.
Quite horrific incidences with people in the public from the 70s and 80s and 90s and onwards. And his films have kind of put those people under a microscope, but also calls into play all of our role within that as spectators, as viewers, as people that like grew up with these heroes that later become fallen heroes and are actually quite monsters, you know, like Jimmy Savile or, you know, all these horrible people. Anyway, I think our guest also has a lot of empathy, and I really like the way that he looks at these very big issues with heart. Mm-hmm. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art
Guy Oliver.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, guys.
Singular.
So
guys,
we're currently in Margate, which is your hometown, my hometown, and now Russell's hometown. We've all moved here.
We're neighbours, essentially.
Yeah, we are. We have been, haven't we, for the last few years.
Why did you move to Margate, Guy?
So I'm together with Lindsay Mendick, your previous guest, and there was one day we were in Sheffield, actually, where Lindsay used to live, and we had a bit of a sort of eureka pop moment, like we could potentially move out of London and we could function and we could pay a lot less for the cost of living. And we thought, well, not Sheffield, because Lindsay's already done Sheffield, but we'd sort of visited Margate not long before that and had a great day. It was like the hottest day of the year, that year, 2019.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd had a nice day. We'd been to visit Jack Lavender and Hannah Lees, two artists who live here, and they just seemed to have a nice life and a nice house, and it was rather idyllic. And we thought, maybe Margate.
And it's like when you go on holiday and it's a beautiful place, you think, I could live here.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If you came on a day and it's pissing down with rain, which most of the year it normally is here, is it?
No, it's not. That's a lie.
Is it?
It's actually a lie, Russ. I'm sorry, I'm really sick of this. The weather report... No, because the weather report constantly says it's raining here. It's hardly rained at all since I've lived
really
here.
It really has hardly rained.
It hardly rains. So let's get that on the record. Margate does not rain. Kent rains, but not Margate. And we've had about two weekends where we had those big storms and we didn't even get them that badly.
All right. Well, imagine if Guy came on one of those big weekends.
And you've not lived here yet. You're just like,
imagine if you came on those big weekends, you might not have wanted to move here as much.
Well,
correct?
Maybe.
You've loved living here, though, haven't you?
Absolutely. And we arrived at sort of bang on the beginning of winter in October 2020.
Which was quite a good test.
And it was in lockdown as well. It was sort of like we escaped London between lockdown one and two, which was such a relief. We were so desperate to get out. But yeah, everyone says, oh, have you done the winter in Margate yet? And it's fine. It's still beautiful.
I think it used to be harder. I think back before the town had started to have restaurants more and like, you know, when everything was boarded up, I imagine living here then probably was quite grim because there wasn't much to do.
Very, very seasonal.
But like since we've all moved here, I think since 2017 onwards, there's such a community here, which you've actually been a huge part of building here, I think, you and Lindsay. Like what you've done with Quench is extraordinary. The way it's brought people together, given a platform for artists who now, you know, a lot of these artists never even had solo shows before.
What is Quench?
Quench is a public space, but you should talk about it because it's your gallery.
So yes, it is a gallery that me and Lindsay founded, and we kind of had a vague idea that we might do this when we moved. We thought, well, you know, we could find a studio space that is reasonable enough that we could have a bit of excess that we could use as a sort of some sort of gallery project space, and we were going to do that in quite a small retail unit that we found in the old town. And then that fell through, and then we found in Cliftonville, which is quite different to the old town, the sort of like beachfront area, quite a large odd basement space. And so sort of Quench became a much bigger thing, and so we wanted to create a platform for artists. It was, it sort of came out of the whole pandemic period when everything was looking very dismal and bleak and things closing, or also just a lot of negativity swirling around and kind of a lot of the kind of the art world wanting to call things out and criticize institutions or criticize anyone. You know, we were kind of in a bit of a tailspin at a certain point, and we kind of, you know, there's still a lot of that that competition to call things out, and we kind of wanted to, I don't know, just be a bit more constructive and do something that could really help other artists. So we kind of created this model where we wouldn't take any commission from what we would show. We wanted to sort of create...
So the artists get 100%?
100% commission.
Because the normal fraction that happens with galleries is that the artists would get 50% and the gallery or the hosting space would get 50%. And that's normally, that's across the board for any art. And I think a lot of people don't realise that. A lot of people seeing artists.
The reason that happens is because the actual running costs of a public space, even the electricity, just the security, the CCTV, all of these things that are involved, the insurance, the shipping is a big part of it, can cost so much money.
Yeah.
And that's what's so unusual about your project, because you've done a lot of crowdfunders, haven't you, to raise money to kind of pay the artists a fee as well. You give them a fee on top of letting them have all the sales.
Do you?
It's very generous.
Yeah, that was our kind of intention, that it was almost like a bursary, that the artists can use the money how they want and kind of don't interfere too much. You know, we kind of, they're sort of self-curated by the artists, the shows. It's the kind of opportunity that, because we come from a background of being artists, it's sort of an
something
ideal
you would love. To,
yes, yeah, exactly. It's the scenario that we'd ideally want.
How do you fund that then?
So we started by doing a crowdfunder campaign by selling editions of artworks, mainly Lindsay's ceramic artworks, and we created merchandise, sort of Quench like tote bags and t-shirts and various other things. And we've done this for 2 years running now, and so that went very well. Like the first year really kind of took off. Mm-hmm. And then following that, we also applied to the Arts Council. So all the money kind of goes towards artists or the running of the gallery, as you say. Mm. Like learning on the job how much money goes towards, you know, just painting out the space, but certainly shipping, transporting works.
And the energy and time that's involved too. Yeah. I mean, I think it's so good the Arts Council came on board to support you. You know, they've regularly supported you now. And I think it's such a brilliant thing because your space... compared to many others. I mean, I just think it's becoming a platform for like super talented people that none
it's
of
a
us know yet.
I guess it's on the art circuit as well for Margate.
Yeah, and it has actually become part of the community in a way that, like, I think people sometimes set things up with that intention. But with you guys, I think it's been so kind of, it wasn't necessarily the main intention, but I think it's become a place that everybody goes to, you know, when they come to Margate.
It's really nice. It's amazing when we hear of people who've, you know, so many people come down from London and beyond to see the shows, and it seems to have, the word seems to have got round.
Why Quench?
Why Quench? we were going through words, for some reason we were going through food-related words, And I suggested pinch, as in like a pinch of salt. And we thought, oh, that kind of, that has a sort of satisfying, onomatopoeic kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we initially were pinch, and then pinch, another arts organisation, got in touch with us to say, we're pinch, you're pinching our name. So I think quench was like a kind of floated around, and it seemed to make sense as a sort of like thirst, seaside, you know, drinks. I don't know.
Yeah, quenching your thirst. Mm. Quenching your cultural thirst.
So I first heard about your own work because you essentially make films. That's like, I know you've made other works, you've made sculptures, you've done all kinds of things and even installations, I guess. But film is something that's a central theme within you. And for those who don't know, Guy also has a penchant for amazing shirts and clothing. So he's even had like the Matrix, like all over denim, kind of like trousers and denim shirt or something.
Well, Lindsay's got the denim jacket, the Matrix jacket. I've got the trousers.
Yeah, you got the trousers. That's right. So you've got this whole kind of pop culture thing that even shows it today in your shirt. Like, can you explain what you're wearing?
It's a sort of Renaissance. I think it's the Sistine Chapel.
Lindsay's
mum found this online, but it's, yes.
But the reason I mentioned that is because of pop culture, because you seem to always reference art, history, culture, but also pop culture within the clothes you wear, but then within the films you're making. So how did you first start getting interested in making films? Did you ever take photographs, or was it always recording on, you know, with a film camera?
Well, as a teenager, and in fact, as long as I can remember, I was always obsessed with films, you know, movie films. And particularly as a teenager, I always wanted, my ambition was to be a, you know, a movie director. Mm. And my whole life was sort of revolved around consuming and compiling films. I used to be really obsessive about my VHS collection. I'd kind of curate individual VHS tapes, so I'd have like three Coen brothers back to back on one tape, and that'd be from recording off the telly, which is something that used to happen, kids. and I used to, you know, my life was sort of revolved around this kind of trivia of film. And
well, we're the same generation as well, because you're not 40 yet, are you? You're 39.
39.
Yeah, so you'll be 40 soon. So
roughly the same age.
So the TV and the films we were watching would have been exactly the same, that sort of 90s, really golden period, it seems like, we talk about in movie making, in Hollywood, in Hollywood superstars being out there. So these sort of influences were really tangible to you.
Yeah, well, I think of the 80s as the golden age for entertainment films, you know, sort of Ghostbusters, Back to the Future, Gremlins,
that's what I'm
Indiana
talking about.
Jones.
Them ones that I'm talking about.
Yeah, and Star Wars. And so that was my kind of formative obsession. I've got two older brothers as well, so it was like those things were our lives. And then sort of going through my teenage years, I became really interested in contemporary art, and it was the kind of Brit art generation. Mm-hmm. And it was fucking hot and exciting and dangerous and edgy, and my parents, you know, hated it, and you know, and it was a sort of like a kind of punk moment for
it. Was tabloidy, wasn't it?
It was sort of crossed over and crashed the mainstream in a really exciting way, and I kind of loved the fact that the tabloids hated it, and you know, I just thought that, look at that, you know, a sheep cut in half in a tank, that's fucking awesome. You know,
there was a real sense of freedom, wasn't there, as well? It was a bit like, fuck you, we're going to do what we want to do. Mm. We're talented, we've got ideas, we're going to change the world. And it felt so exciting as a teenager to see all that, didn't it?
Yeah, and that they were young, and the work was immediate. You could kind of, you didn't need to understand, I don't know, you didn't need a theoretical understanding of it.
Yeah, you didn't need a degree in art history or something.
It was visceral.
Yeah.
You know, it was punchy. And so gradually, I suppose, the two things merged, and I kind of understood that there was a thing called video art as well. Mm. And so these sort of twin obsessions of art, and, you know, art was always my sort of like thing I was best at school, I suppose, you know, good at drawing. These obsessions kind of merged into making video art.
Did you see video art at that time that made you go, oh, eureka, that's the angle I can go down?
Yeah, I remember seeing things like Douglas Gordon and, I don't know, like the Wilson twins, and I'm trying to think. And then kind of I did a foundation course at Middlesex Uni. I kind of discovered the works of like John Smith, who's remained a huge influential figure.
What was John Smith work like?
John Smith has been making work since the 70s, so he's kind of like a godfather of sort of British conceptual video art. He's now represented by Kate McGarry Gallery. He's got a very influential figure, and was kind of pioneering in terms of kind of merging conceptual art with a sort of comedic strand. And his like most famous film is called A Girl Chewing Gum. And he filmed it. It was like filmed in 1977, I think, with a film camera, just shot in a street in Dalston. And the joke is, or the conceit is, you hear the voice of a director coordinating what you see on screen, but basically it's just a random street scene. Mm-hmm. And so he said, right now the two teenagers, can you walk by from the left? That's good. And the Ford Fiesta, can you move just right, pull up? And it so it's like a great, I always think of it, it's almost like a two Ronnie sketch. Yeah. It's like very close, and it's like something that I think about a lot. So it's a comedy features a lot in my work, like as a subject.
Humor's a huge
material. And so I've always been inspired by comedy and comedians. John Smith is this sort of like interesting kind of bridge between kind of conceptual art and kind of televisual comedy.
Because you did your MA at the RCA, and your degree, you had a video called The Embarrassadors, which is based on a Holbein painting, The Ambassadors, which is at the National Gallery.
Yeah.
And you...
How did you see that? I'm trying to think where...
It's online. Oh, yeah. It's online, mate. I found it, and it's you are playing yourself filming and doing the silly voices for both of the ambassadors, and then you're also playing the security guard that's telling you to get out, and one of the ambassadors farts at one point, the other one's really embarrassed. And it's so stupid, but brilliant, and kind of, I can see how you started there and where you're at now. And you've always been part of the narrative. You're not someone that guy appears, whether you become a trope of something in your material or you are playing a male character archetype. You're always present, and you are always leading the audience somewhere.
If I was to sum up what my work is about, it's kind of about popular culture and my relationship to it and how it sort of has intertwined in my life. And you know, the sort of narrative of life is punctuated by the sort of wider cultural landscape of what we kind of, you know, consume and absorb. And kind of issues of time and memory in relation to all of that. It all feeds in, and I'm kind of there, I suppose. And that's, I'm trying to think, there was a point when I just suddenly realized, oh, well, I can be in the films because that's kind of going to be easier. Mm. But then you can't then detangle yourself from it. I suppose one of the first sort of like performative videos I did when I was doing my degree, whereas I kind of performed as a wrestler. I was obsessed with WWF.
Me too.
Wrestling.
Who was your favourite?
Ultimate Warrior.
Oh my God, yeah. So I like Big Boss Man.
Oh yeah.
And the Bushwhackers.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that era. Mm-hmm. And it's, for me, it's WWF. I don't care about WWE.
WCW?
No, WWE. It changed to WWE.
Oh, did it? I remember one Christmas, I was obsessed with WWF. My mum got me a WCW
The
wrestling ring.
Yeah.
And I was like, you can't mix WWF toys with the WCW ring. And she was quite devastated. Yeah. I think she was. And I was like,
that's the poor man's, you know, option. Yeah.
No, absolutely not. So you were loyal to WWF.
Yeah.
And you made a film about being a wrestler.
I started kind of like revisited that as a subject. I started making these kind of video collages of all the old footage and stuff, and kind of going back. There's two things. So one, I kind of wanted to kind of revisit this obsession with the Ultimate Warrior, who had this kind of face paint design and was this kind of wild, spiritual kind of nutcase.
Yeah.
Who's just like, a force of steroid energy just running around and swirl of color and stuff. The first one I did was where I'm in my bedroom in halls, actually, at my university, and I perform the song Runaway by Del Shannon in the role of
Runaway, turn up.
No,
it's Bronski Beat.
Wah, 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 wonder. Why? Why?
She ran away. This is a Guy classic. He's a great singer.
No, no, no.
By the way, Guy is never off karaoke in Neighbours Lindsay. It's like yeah. Your thing.
It does come out karaoke, that particular number.
I'm sure I've heard it, actually. That's what I thought.
Yeah. And so, this kind of idea of kind of mixing two incongruous kind of references with me as the sort of conduit in the middle.
Yeah.
And it kind of, it also, I suppose there's always a sort of tragicomic element to my work.
Mm. That there's comedy tragedy is, you know, runs all the way through.
Absurdity with a sort of sadness or melancholy, and why the subject of the WWF wrestlers was so interesting, because at that point I realized that most of them were dead. They were prematurely dying.
Really?
And I'm sorry to tell you,
if
you don't know, Big Boss Man died in his 40s, and Ultimate Warrior's dead.
Why did they die? Because of steroids and like brain hemorrhages or something?
Yeah.
Banging your head around.
Various.
Like, I've heard that rugby players now,
they're basically dancers,
are all getting brain tumors, aren't they?
No, but they injured themselves constantly, so they would be then addicted to painkillers and various other drugs. There's a lot of cocaine.
The Undertaker's still alive.
He is, and he's still wrestling, weirdly. He's the only one, which is weird, because his role was being dead as the Undertaker.
Yeah, that's right. So he's living forever.
But yeah, Andre the Giant, Mr. Perfect, Texas Tornado.
Hulk Hogan's still alive.
He's still alive, yeah.
Legend.
Weirdly, he was old.
Jake the Snake?
He's still alive.
So basically, they're all still alive.
Typhoon and Earthquake.
Earthquake's dead.
Earthquake's dead?
Yeah, I think Typhoon died as well.
Legion of Doom?
They're both dead now.
No, both dead?
Both dead, yeah.
No.
I'm
my heart's broken.
Macho Man's dead.
No, Randy Savage?
Yeah.
This is too much.
It's a lot. I'm sorry to tell you. Ravishing Rick Rude.
No.
Is this in your film then, the fact they've all died?
This film I made when I was doing my degree, and I kind of like made a sort of montage at the end of all of them that died.
God.
And so there's this sort of like weird mortality thing that runs through my work as well, that I keep kind of going back to kind of ideas of ghosts or kind of the like I made a film recently, The Year That Everyone Died.
Yes, which I've seen.
Yeah, and it's kind of about...
It's a brain fuck, that film.
Yeah.
Because it's a your nan passed and you were very close to her, and the year she passed... Is this right? And everybody...
Yeah, it's about 2016, basically. And I think people were sort of very conscious of it at the time, that for some reason it just seemed to be a kind of flurry of celebrities, quite high-profile celebrities dying, often, you know, not that old. Like David Bowie died, and people like Prince died, and loads of high-profile people, Muhammad Ali, Alan Rickman, Victoria Wood. And I sort of focused on this. And basically, it's a bit like, you know, the bit in the Oscars when the year...
In memoriam.
It's kind of like that, but kind of expanding it to a sort of like absurd degree. And I kind of create this kind of long form poem, basically, poem song thing. It's all in kind of rhyming form. I'm kind of interested in how time creates kind of arbitrary connections that, you know, there's nothing else really connects. So-and-so and so-and-so, like Carrie Fisher and George Michael. But the fact that they sort of died, and so that...
They died in 2016 as well?
Yeah, they died in successive days. So George Michael died on Christmas Day, and then Carrie Fisher died on Boxing Day.
Oh, my God.
And it was just sort of, like, relentless the whole year.
But I guess it's also, like, as a spectator or public, you're watching all these different things. So you might see a Star Wars movie, you might listen to one of his songs, and it creates this kind of like cultural tapestry within our minds, doesn't it? So I guess there are like connections, almost like if it's a galaxy of all these stars, like as in like celebrities, but somehow there is like a connection between them all. And what I liked about your film was like the spark for the film is actually the loss of a family member, and then you've got your own kind of grief. But then it's interesting thinking about how you can almost let your own grief out through grieving these people that you didn't even know. Do you know what I mean? There's this, I found that really fascinating.
Yeah, so I mix together, I do it all in chronology. It's so from the start of the year to the end. Mm. And so there's sort of, I lost a couple of friends that year and a couple of family members. Mm. So it's kind of, it's all kind of woven together essentially, because that's the thing. It's kind of, you have relationships with celebrity figures that you don't know, usually through their art or whatever they've made. But you do kind of feel like you know them and you have a sense of loss when they die.
Yeah, totally.
And so, yeah, as I say, it's kind of very much about how these things connect with your own life. And I remember being at the funeral of my friend John, and, and it was that week that Prince and Victoria Wood died, and it was all just so much to sort of
well, the reality of death, I guess, yeah, was something very present, omnipresent.
It just seemed to hang over everything, and also it was just a shit year because it was the year of Brexit and of Trump's election, and so it just
dark times.
So I kind of like mixed them all together, and I'm just sort of. I'm interested in not compiling years, but what creating a kind of commemoration of particular times. Just recently been making these collages that are I've got these books, these yearbooks of like the kind of a compendium of a specific year. Mm. I've been creating these collages that are kind of abstract, but they are a kind of accumulation of images of that year. But I do it through this kind of automatic process, so I can transfer where that image lay on the page onto a new piece of paper, and then you kind of overlay. So there's this arbitrary process to the image making that it is.
But this is an analog. This isn't a film now.
This is analog.
Oh wow.
Yeah, yeah. So it kind of there's a sort of parallel. I kind of think of myself as a bit of a collagist, even.
I've seen your Jar Jar Binks collages, which are a triumph. I think there's three versions of those. We have Jar Jar Binks, and you have collage, like paintwork in there, yeah, and brushstroke, and
yeah. I kind of wanted to use a very identifiable figurative image as a sort of abstraction at the same time, but also it's like a really loaded thing. And they were a bit on the bone actually, kind of making them, because it's I don't know if you know, but Jar Jar Binks was sort of like very controversial even when it came out as being a kind of dodgy racial caricature.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, kind of broad kind of Caribbean type stereotype. And so I kind of wanted to choose that one because Star Wars meant a lot to me, but. Jar Jar Binks was this sort of like hated, sort of misjudged on every level thing. Mm. Those whole kind of prequels, I hated them. And they were a great disappointment. It was like, it started as this sort of like, how can I make an ode to cultural failure or disappointment?
Yeah.
Because it took me years to get over that those films were bad. Because I've been waiting my whole life for them.
Oh, yeah,
I know. And do you like the newer ones?
The newer ones, yes, they were fine. It was what we needed to kind of get over the prequel films.
But this ode to cultural failure, that runs through, for me, most of your work, if not all of your work.
Yeah, I think I'm drawn to kind of mess and sort of...
But through your own, you've described it as your own personal mangled nostalgia.
Yeah.
Which is, so as we said, you set yourself in the narrative, but you are attracted to messy situations, but normally with men in the public eye.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always, and I think it started with the wrestling subject that it was coming back to, a kind of...
Is it the alpha?
Yeah, the fact that it's such a sort of hyper exaggerated alpha vision of masculinity, these pumped up steroid men, and the kind of ridiculous sort of pantomime. It's quite, it's super camp when you look at it as well, ironically. And then kind of...
Yeah, the little pants and everything. It's like,
yeah, and the whole theatre of it, and the drama of it, the melodrama of it.
It's quite Shakespearean or something. It's quite old-fashioned, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, they're also amazing actors and performers. It's sort of like it gets forgotten that, like, you're in character like that. It's like...
Oh. I bet a lot of them started off as actors and then they fell into
and quite
steroids
a few have,
and,
have,
then, and then got into wrestling.
Yeah, and lots of have crossed over, like The Rock or, into film acting. But, yeah, and then kind of... Yeah, the wrestling with this sort of like, with these kind of sad male love songs. I did another one with like a Roy Orbison song where I was painting my face as in reverse as the Ultimate Warrior. Kind of that, this idea of kind of male vulnerability was a thing that I kind of focused on at that point of my art practice. And yeah, kind of ideas of masculine culture has kind of continued through my work.
Well, toxic masculinity, masculine identity, all of these phrases that are kind of buzzwords now for describing what it's like to be a man in society.
Yeah.
These are things that you are constantly mining and working through and experimenting with and analysing through your practice. And this film that I saw when I first came to your work, which was called You Know Nothing of My Work,
yeah,
2020 at the Gerwood Space, was something that I found so incredible and nuanced and clever and troubling and problematic and everything, you tackled it head on in tackling material that people are terrified to go near. And we're talking about men that have been shamed publicly through the most heinous crimes, but they were once upheld as being, you know, the height of culture, the height of entertainment, people, heroes. Yep. For many people, and they've fallen off their pedestals. And as a society with cancel culture and post-Me Too movement, we're all told to just kick them to the curb, forget about it. And there's something in you where, as Rob said at the beginning, you have this empathy where you're trying to understand that through your own narrative, which is so complicated and complex, but you do it in such an original, fresh, humorous way that you get it. And I've heard so many interviews, sorry, I'm going to let you talk. I've just heard so many interviews where they talk about the subject of your work rather than the work as a whole. And everything I've been listening to of today is always about like you having to sort of defend your choices or defend the reason why you're attracted to that and not actually about the process of making that.
Well, it's something that started a few years ago, this kind of obsession with like, what do we do? You know, it's an age old thing about, if you admire an artist or an artwork, and they're a shit person, how do you reconcile that?
What happens to the artwork? Does it end up in the art bin?
Yeah, how do you separate? Do you separate the talent from the musician? Yeah, you mean like Michael Jackson now?
Yeah.
It's still someone that you can walk into a shop and they're still be playing his music.
Yes.
But we all know, everybody in the world knows or thinks they understand of what he did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, R. Kelly's been scrapped now, hasn't he? I think that's gone. But these are fascinating, you know, modern times we're living in, that these highly talented, popular culture figures are being erased.
Well, it's like not like these are peripheral figures from culture. These are sort of giants. These are sort of like people who you can't conveniently pick them out and you know, erase them.
Yeah, they're so much part of the fabric of life, aren't they? Like their creative contribution. But then behind the scenes, they were actually monsters and like we never knew.
But they changed the game for so many other people.
Exactly,
that we love still.
Yeah, it's really strange.
Exactly. And I think Michael Jackson is such an important figure within that. And it was interesting because one of the reasons why I sort of really kind of accelerated in my head was there was that exhibition around him at the National Portrait Gallery in 2019, Michael Jackson on the Wall, which was a really interesting show. Kind of, it was a sort of quite compendium of artworks of artists' work that was inspired by him and his music, and because he's had such a sort of profound cultural impact on the planet, and so of course it's like a sort of valid subject, but. Then when the Finding Neverland film came out the following year, I thought, God, how lucky they were that it didn't sort of like coincide, you know, and they would have been fucked basically, just in terms of the backlash. And, you know, I think we're all experiencing a sort of opening of our eyes in a lot of ways. I think, you know, we're experiencing a lot of sort of vast cultural change in the last 5 years particularly. And that things like the allegations around Michael Jackson, we kind of had this sort of odd amnesia about, that we let it kind of float away, that we don't know, you know, nothing was proven, blah, blah, blah. And then it's sort of like, hang on. No, it was always there. It was always there was always enough to give us a clue of what was really going on. But it's also hard, because it's sort of like the devotion of that he kind of generated, and the love of his music, you know, was so massive. I mean, growing up, he was the most famous person in the world, and so it was
on the planet,
literally,
absolutely.
So you have this idea of legacy, and then as an artist, and then the artist gets exposed. What do you do? How do you navigate that with the sort of relationship to the artwork? So that's how it started, and literally within the film, I'm sort of playing a role of myself, and the film starts with me walking into a charity shop. I'm kind of like a sort of naive version of myself.
Which is one of your favourite things to do.
Yeah, there's a sort of
charity shopping.
Yeah. that I do love, yeah. And this literally would happen of me going into to browse through the CDs, because I still sort of like go through old CDs, and I would find Lost Prophets CDs. And Lost Prophets was a sort of punk band who, if you know of them, you'll know that the lead singer's in jail now because he's a paedophile. And it was a really fucked up, horrible case. And so they just like overnight just not talked about. But then you sort of see them. And it's sort of weird concept of things poking through inconveniently. They're just sort of popping up, things that you try and sort of suppress, like a kind of a boil or something, you know.
You put a plaster over it and hide it.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd be in charity shop, I think, and it starts off, and I think you pull out a Rolf Harris and you're...
Yeah, the idea is that they then look around and see all of these materials, all these old books and DVDs by these guys who are now, you know, disgraced or discredited.
Yeah,
or
Kevin Spacey, Woody Allen.
Mm. Yeah, Mel Gibson was in there. O.J. Simpson. You know, like, it's a wide array now. Yeah, there's a lot of them.
There's a lot.
We've all had to kind of confront this. We've all kind of thought about this. And it's I like kind of taking subjects that people already have some kind of grip on.
Oh, yeah, like an understanding of, yeah, their own response to it. But also that you, when I was watching it, you've got a real feeling is like, why is he talking about this? Because you do feel like you're not supposed to. And yeah, like, but what's fascinating about it is I think your film highlights the kind of systematic errors and structures that were around those people that almost enabled their evil behavior. Or do you know what I mean? Like the super fame of someone like Michael Jackson or like Jimmy Savile, all these people, and then suddenly the freedom that might give them or something. It's really dark.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But also the thing that made me think in your films is I sometimes really struggle watching film art from start to finish, and I might dip in, but with your one I watched it from start to finish because you kind of can't not. And I'm really glad I did, because as it goes on, it's almost in like chapters, that film.
Yeah, it's multi-chapter.
And, I mean, with, what do you call it? Spoiler alert. But towards the end, it's like there's this eureka moment with a guest, a friend of yours who's in it, who just sort of makes it all, you know, you suddenly see a different perspective, the voice of a woman, and it's really strong. I mean, it's such a great ending to the film.
Well, it is... It would change it if you just saw the first couple of chapters
totally.
And not later. And you know, some of it's quite obnoxious, and it's sort of like, you know, I'm also playing with this sort of BBC type character of a sort of broadcaster type figure, which I've sort of done before. I'm kind of interested in those old sort of very BBC related kind of documentary old roles of the sort of arts authority broadcaster figure. Mm-hmm. You know, people like kind of Robert Hughes or Kenneth Clark, and kind of using that as a sort of as a reference point in itself, because the BBC, I do kind of implicate them, I suppose, that, you know, these figures, Rolf Harris and Jimmy Savile in particular, that were just there, and Top of the Pops particularly.
Mm-hmm. Your mum was a dancer on Top of the Pops.
She was there, and she remembers seeing Jimmy Savile, and she sort of says that, you know, that everyone knew he was creepy, mm-hmm. you know, but apparently it was just that everything at the Top of the Pops was just rife. Everyone was in on it, and it was just a sort of a free-for-all and really, really vile. Which is so sad, because something like Top of the Pops was so important culturally, you know, in the cultural history of this country, was essential, and we remember it, you know, when we were young. It's sad that it doesn't exist, but it's, you know, then you feel bad, so, like, perhaps it should, you know, be consigned to the dustbin, because it was, you know, this dark side, this underside to it, which was vile. But yeah, where was I? The thread through the film, it's supposed to be, I wanted it to be a genuine kind of journey of discovery, that I am this figure that through kind of different conversations actually learns more about it, which was sort of echoed the making of it, you know, because I was having conversations with people. I think the scene you're talking about with Rebecca Taylor, who's the singer Self Esteem, she plays... we didn't actually say it's a musical as well. It's sort of the whole film is done in a musical form.
Your singing skills are documented on film.
Yes. We won't talk about that. But
amazing.
That's the sort of joke as well, that I can't really sing and I'm not a singer, but Rebecca certainly can. And in this film, I'm kind of playing a kind of university type lecturer who's being challenged by Rebecca's character. And it's done through kind of song form, and it's called actually Trapped in the Lecture Theatre, which is a reference to Trapped in the Closet by R. Kelly, and kind of using sort of like references to musical references to that. And so it acts as an important kind of deconstruction of my position as me, kind of as a you know, a white straight male artist kind of tackling the subject, and the problems of that, and the kind of you know, the weaknesses that I would have as a sort of putting myself as a sort of authority figure analyzing this in a sort of objective academic sort of way. And that's very much those ideas came about through conversations with Lindsay in particular, of her really challenging me. It's like, no, it's all very well for you to sort of find these things interesting, but no, it's very different. If you know, depending on who you are, there's very important perspectives that you need to kind of think about.
It's incredibly uncomfortable, and you have to be so sensitive. And making this work, did you have panics and fears when you were putting it out there?
Well, it's weird because we finished it just bang on the start of the pandemic, really. It was like March the 13th, 2020, and it was supposed to be shown in April. And so it had to be shelved for 6 months, and we didn't watch it during that time. And me and Lindsay watched it at the opening, and we both thought, oh, fucking hell, did I do this? You know, I suppose the subject is the sort of anxiety about talking about it. So, and I suppose that's why I've used humour in a way to kind of satirise my own anxious feelings about what can we talk about when it comes to this, or what do we think, what are we supposed to think about these things? Like, can I watch Kevin Spacey's movies? Can I listen to R. Kelly's music? There's a sort of social etiquette around these things, because, as I said before, things are changing very quickly and things are being thrashed out in the public. It's a sort of battle for sort of public values. And it's quite an exciting time, but it's also quite, you know, a time full of anxiety and trepidation. Yeah. And no one's really sure, you know, look at institutions, you know, like soon after that, you know, when the Tate pulled the Philip Guston exhibition, you know, there's so much fear of making a wrong move. And I suppose I did sort of dive into that headlong in a sort of foolhardy
way. No one else is doing it. That's what's so incredible is that no one else is... It takes some bravery to tackle that as well.
Well, also then, is it a kind of a double trick, you know, is it a double bluff, you know, am I virtue signalling by kind of putting myself in? And I kind of want the viewer to be confused by that.
You're with you, then you're kind of like, hang on a minute, mate, and then you're with you again. Because you're playing all these archetypes, you are challenging yourself constantly and having people come in, like Rebecca's character, who's challenging you, but the public consensus, you know, public opinion is constantly going back and forth, politics, it's always shifting, isn't it? There isn't really... I mean, in these cases, yes, there is a right and wrong. But what you're saying, and this is in the way that people can talk about it, it's like, what's right, what is wrong?
Yeah, and I think that the idea of... I wanted to implicate myself because I want the viewers to sort of like question their own positions. It's sort of the fact that it kind of... I guess a lot of my work comes down to kind of ideas of morality, I suppose. And it being, I don't want... Well, life isn't... straightforward, and life, you know, moral questions are complicated, and when people kind of people call out, you can sometimes be suspicious about why people are calling things out, because of course it separates any person from what they're criticizing. It elevates them. If they're in a position of criticizing something, they are sort of elevated from the subject. And, you know, when it borders into sort of self-righteousness or a kind of self-satisfied criticism, rather than questioning whether, well, perhaps we're all complicit. I suppose I'm interested in the fact of society and culture being kind of interconnected in a very complicated way, that, you know, we live in this country, so you kind of have to accept the country as a whole, or, you know, you have to participate in culture and take sort of responsibility for it, which doesn't mean kind of separating yourself. And perhaps, sort of, I think the idea of disagreement is very interesting to me now. I think we're less able to have political differences with each other in sort of public discourses. It gets more and more... What do you call it? Kind of exacerbated to a kind of like a heightened hysterical degree. Yeah, there's no kind of actual dialogue. I implicate myself, but as a way of sort of offering the viewer to implicate themselves.
Yeah. I also like the fact that art can be a space to have those uncomfortable conversations, and that it is an artwork. Do you know what I mean, Len? The audience is intelligent enough to sit down and watch your film and go on that journey with you and understands that you're, you know, highlighting these issues from a very particular point of view, if you get what I mean. Like, I don't know, I think it's the fact it's an artwork and that you've chosen to make a film, like an art film, is really important. Because if you think of like Gaston, for example, it's quite patronizing of them to take that show down and like cancel it all. It's now all going back on again, I heard. Yeah, I think the Tate are now putting it on. Yeah. But this idea that the audience isn't intelligent
that they
enough
can't work
to understand
out, they can't
that
hold complex
he wasn't
ideas
racist. Do you know what I mean? It's like, of course, we've all got the capacity to hold complex ideas and understand things. Like, and also that's the point of art is to bring up those issues for us to confront them within ourselves. Like, that's what I think is really great about your films, is that they, you know, they're doing what art should do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's no like conclusion, really.
No.
Like, I don't have, I say it in the film, I don't have the answers. I still don't know what we do with, you know, with Michael Jackson's music.
Yeah.
You know, is it okay?
It's true, though. I go to the supermarket and you sometimes still hear it playing. It's not like it hasn't been totally...
But you're not saying this is what we should be doing.
No.
You're just analysing and questioning, which is what we as a society are doing.
Yeah.
But you're questioning uncomfortable things. You're challenging cancel culture through disarming musical comedy.
I guess so. But I like the fact that it kind of doesn't necessarily look like an art film. It is almost like a sort of... a sort of elaborate sketch theatrical comedy thing.
Televisual. Even the way you present things and say the way your speech is, you know, the way you're using language and your voice is really deliberate, isn't it? It's like,
yeah,
Do you still want to direct movies?
I still have a sort of desire, yeah. And it's nice that there are quite a few contemporary artists that sort of move over into feature film.
Yeah, Steve McQueen, Sam Taylor Wood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of important precedence.
Hello. Oh, thank you for joining.
Sorry, I don't know what just happened there. That's your, you been doing an interview with somebody.
Oh.
Yeah, it's on the film and video umbrella.
Fair enough.
So what is forthcoming for you? So you're in Margate. Lindsay's working very hard. You're working very hard. What are you working very hard on at the minute, Guy, apart from running a gallery space that's not profit for you guys?
Well, I'm starting a project, a new film project, that is probably going to be the most personal thing I've done because it's the subject is my family, I suppose, or a kind of particular time in the life of my family, basically like our adolescence. So I've got... I'm the youngest of three brothers, so I've got two older brothers. And I suppose the overall title of the project is called Badly Drawn Boys, because there was a period of time when we were just in and out of hospital a lot. Either through accidents, but mostly conditions. Me and my middle brother both had scoliosis, which is spinal curvature. And so he had surgery when he was 15, when it was discovered. And then soon after that, I was discovered to have it at early stages. And so I sort of like my teens were sort of dominated by being sort of treated for that. And then I had surgery for that when I was 18.
On your spine?
On my spine. So,
oh my God.
So I've got two metal rods in my spine that stayed there for life. So they're about a foot long. So most of my spine is sort of rigid.
And didn't you have to wear a brace for a long time?
Yeah.
You had to go to school for a year or something wearing a brace.
For a few years.
A few years, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you beat when you go through security?
It's always the first question.
Is it?
But not through the arch, but if you wave the wand, there, yeah.
It does
go off.
did you experience a lot of bullying then in that era when you were at school?
Well, sometimes people would call me cripple to...
Really?
Something like that, sort of wind me up and then it would sort of... kick off and because I kind of didn't wear uniform because I had this brace, so I had to sort of wear loose fitting clothing. So it was
quite a lot to go through at 18, isn't it?
Well, it was from 13 to 18. So it was sort of, I think I was started wearing the brace when I was 12 or 13.
How's your brother now? Is he fine?
He had more complications than me, but it was just this kind of weird run, and it was sort of like we also both got appendicitis within that, and then my other brother got hit by a car. And it was sort of successive years in the 90s. So there was a point where we all had metalwork in our bodies at the same time. And it's just the fact that it was sort of centered around our adolescence and sort of the idea of, I suppose I'm making sort of metaphorical links between sort of development and growth and how they kind of informed us as adults, and kind of looking back, sort of I'm about to turn 40, my brothers are in their 40s. This idea of kind of looking back at that time, how it sort of defined life for us in a lot of ways, but also it kind of helped me become an artist, I suppose, because I documented that time. I made an art project out of it when I was still in my sixth form. And it sort of featured a little bit, or just that it was this, this formative time.
And you used to document it, didn't you, yourself? You would document what you were going through?
I had a video camera in hospital. I made a film around it.
So is this going to feature in the latest?
Well, the film is potentially digitally lost, unfortunately. Yeah. But there's a lot of photographic documentation. But the fact that this film is lost will become part of the...
part of the narrative.
The new film.
Yeah.
Which is sort of I always kind of weave in the failure of making often within my films. Mm. There was one time when I made a film about learning to ride a bike because I never learned to ride a bike.
Still haven't.
The only time I have was to make this film the one day. And it's sort of, there's lots of ideas about kind of childhood. I suppose this idea of masculinity that runs through it is a sort of not a failure of adulthood, but a kind of anxiety about adulthood, never feeling fully adult, and like not being able to ride a bike being a sort of metaphor
like you have to
of
come
that,
out, isn't it? It's like I can't drive, I can't ride a bike, I can't swim.
Yeah,
it feels like people go, "What?" It's like what do you call it? A social contract that you get to a certain age, you should be able to do all these things, obviously.
Exactly.
And if you don't, it's like, "Well, what happened to you?"
Yeah, you're like, "Why are you not a proper adult?"
But
within the making of that was all quite a haphazard day, and I got this guy, the student, to help me film it, and as I'm cycling off down the way, the camera picks up him talking to his friend saying, "I'm working with this guy. He doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. He's an absolute idiot. He didn't have a camera." And so I ended up keeping that in the film.
Oh, brilliant.
I love that. So this one's a musical as well or not? Sorry.
No, music is always featured in it. I use the song "Song for Guy" by Elton John as the soundtrack to that film, actually, and then I start.
There's no words in that song,
except at the end where he repeats the phrase "Life isn't everything," and then I mime those words. Beautiful song.
It's interesting, this idea of like failure of creativity as well, because I was talking to someone about Louise Bourgeois. I went and saw her show in London, and apparently when she finished her work, to her it was gone, and she didn't really have that much emotional response to it. I mean, I'm sure she still cared about it, but if something got lost or disappeared, I don't think she minded, apparently. And there's a famous footage of her throwing where she throws a sculpture when it's finished.
There's a few of her ceramic sculptures. She's just chucking them on the floor.
Yeah, and they smash, don't they?
And it's very gestural. It's quite theatrical.
Yeah,
like, she's obviously doing it for effect.
But the idea that like the work is enough, that like the idea in the process
is conceptual,
of making
it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but also like I hate losing things, and it's sort of like it's been this sort of terror that I think I don't know if this thing still exists, and I don't know how to tell my family that it doesn't quite exist, because it was like a very important sort of document.
Is VHS tape just like
we had it on VHS tapes, and then I don't know what happened to them, and it was on a computer, but this was back in like 2000, 2001, and it's like.
Oh, it's got to be on a cloud somewhere.
We'll see. I've got some old DV tapes. It might be, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm sort of terrified of looking, because it's like that sort of...
Because you like all hope is there.
Yeah, I can pretend that it might exist somewhere if I look and can't find it. But either way, it's like it's there. It will then sort of like a sort of remaking of that will exist within the film, hopefully.
I've always found it really unfair for video artists, like the lack of support and the way that, you know, if you're a painter, it's so much easier in a sense to suddenly make money and like have something that's a commodity that people can understand much faster. And of course there's really successful film artists and artists that make performances and all different kinds of things. But what's it been like for you? Because I know you've had a lot of support from different organizations like the Film and Video Umbrella and Gerwood in
particular.
And the
Jarman Award.
And the Jarman Award, which you were nominated for, yeah. Like, has that been like life-changing and really helped you to make your work?
Yeah, it was, particularly so it's Gerwood and Film and Video Umbrella who work together. They do an annual film award. And it was something that I'd always dreamed about. I knew this award existed. I always followed it. And I'd actually been, I'd got to interview twice before I actually got it. So I was like incredibly close. That was really heartbreaking. And I finally got it. And to actually have that whole kind of team around you, like, because you can't make films on your own. It really is a sort of collaborative process, however you want to, you know, go about making your work.
The edit, you're by yourself. Like, the materiality of that is you and a laptop and an edit system.
Yeah, and that's why I'm most comfortable, really, I suppose, of any kind of technique that I use as an artist. I love editing, and I often use a lot of found footage. So I'm kind of happy just not involving myself with loads of other people, but that was such a great experience, being assigned a producer and kind of working with the whole team, and then having like a crew for the shoots that we did, and how collaborative it was. Actually, it really did sort of help me to kind of reach out and kind of expand. I wouldn't have made the film that I did if it wasn't, you know, for working with, you know, with Lindsay, with Rebecca, with Susie, who did the music, Susie Davis, with and it was really important, you know, kind of working with women with sort of like the subject that I was working on, you know. And Katie Byford, my producer. It was massive, and it's hard to kind of, once you've done that, what kind of have that kind of experience, it's hard to sort of get it again without getting a kind of major commission. But, you know, it's sort of, you find you as an artist, you just have to be resilient and kind of work with people. You kind of scramble things together.
And, you have to keep the hope, don't you? And the kind of the belief that it's what you should be doing in order to keep making. It's a really hard
thing. Yeah, and also the inspiration, because these, you know, you can go to studio if you are an analog painter, drawer. You're there head to hand to paper, canvas. But if you're making films, it's a long-term commitment, isn't it? And to come up with them ideas and the edit, it's like these artworks might take a year more to kind of finalise.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. And it's sort of like, it's such an irrational thing to make art anyway. So it's a sort of scary thing to having to front money up front. When it's hard, as you say, it's hard to make money back. But thankfully, you know, there's a big place for video art in the art world. Even though it's harder to make money. And I'm working towards a new project now. I'm applying for funding. I'm optimistic, you know, one by hook or by crook, it will happen.
Are they editions, your films, in?
Yes, they usually are.
What's the edition number?
5, I think we worked out with the You Know Nothing of My Work.
And you've sold your work, haven't you?
I have in the past, yes. Yeah. But not a lot in terms of video editions.
Do you ever get frustrated with yourself that is your chosen medium of choice to tell your stories?
You do get jealous of painters or other, you know, practitioners for the sort of directness of it and the kind of the opportunities for making money. But I don't know. I know that is my kind of, although I always make other stuff, that's the thing I have an affinity for. Mm. And I kind of, it's my sort of natural medium, you know. Mm.
What's it been like collaborating with, even like with Lindsay, who's your partner, obviously, but I know you've made films with her.
Yeah.
Like you've helped edit and contribute to the films. I think they're even titled as both of your names on the films, like the one that was in London recently at Cook Latham Gallery. Yeah. What's it like working with someone you're going out with, but also someone like Rebecca, you know, self-esteem, who's got this incredible presence and strength of character? Is it really, did you sort of learn a lot from both of them?
Yeah, definitely. The films I've made with Lindsay have been really great, actually, because they're definitely her works and her concept. So I'm kind of... she has an idea of what she wants and that I can kind of, I have a certain amount of free rein to kind of create that. I think, and we've talked about this, if it was a genuine kind of collaboration where we had to sort of like, where we were kind of 50-50 partners to create something new, that would be really complicated and could sort of lead to conflict. Because we're just, you know, we're both very headstrong as artists, or we have, you know, a kind of defined language.
Yeah.
And it would be hard to split that 50-50. I mean, Lindsay is very good at collaborating. I mean, the show that she's doing for Carl Friedman, it's involving a number of people, you know, fulfilling different roles. And as I say, like, it was great to kind of have that experience. I reached out to so many people. I wanted, like, for the Gerwood FVU project, I was reaching out to journalists and things, and I tried to get in touch with a musician that really nearly happened, actually. This guy called Jeffrey Lewis. I don't know if you know him. He's a singer-songwriter from New York who's always been one of my biggest inspirations, actually. He kind of inspired the kind of the rhyming song form style that I've kind of fallen into. Mm. He does these kind of narrative, very witty, very kind of ingenious kind of wordplay songs about... And he, you know, he's a kind of beta male caricature, like not, you know, he is himself, but he's very what do you say? He kind of makes work about his own sort of failings, I suppose. Mm. And there was this interesting thing. There's a Woody Allen thread throughout that film that I kind of saw, like, me and Jeffrey Lewis as sort of offspring in some way of someone like Woody Allen. Mm. So Woody Allen has always been a massive inspiration for me. Mm. To say I sort of take inspiration from comedians and songwriters.
And also another, he's a very complicated person.
Yeah,
well,
and actually a lot of grieving on your side. For that's a hero that's really falling.
Yeah, and I think it was important to kind of take somebody that really meant a lot to me culturally, creatively, and that I've taken a large amount of inspiration from. You know, I still think as an artist he's massively important. He kind of elevated the kind of the concept of what comedy can do. And as a sort of postmodern figure, he's, you know, really influential and groundbreaking. But now we kind of, we know certain things for fact, and there are other things that he's been accused of. But it's very complicated when it's an artist that's so tied to themselves, that their whole art is tied to their own persona. Because some artists have a separation, you know, when we talk about like Wagner or something, of being a complicated, problematic figure in music. Well,
why problematic? What did he do?
Well, he was a big influence on Adolf Hitler. He was a massive anti-Semite and wrote a lot of kind of sadly influential writing.
Wagner's revered. I mean,
But it's been controversial in the classical music world. He's not played in Israel, that's for sure.
Right. Oh my God.
So he's kind of one of those integral figures of like, oh, can you separate art from the artist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's like, because it's music, the music itself doesn't have content.
The music doesn't have words.
It's abstract, essentially.
Yeah, it's not his voice singing over the top of it. Or.
But then with Woody Allen, his whole life was there in his work, and it becomes very uncomfortable when you watch like Manhattan, where he's dating a 17-year-old girl, and it's treated as sort of normal. And there's other weird things within his work where you think, why are you including that? That's, you know, like jokes about.
Yeah, it's bad, isn't it?
There's an awkward scene in Stardust Memories where his girlfriend is accusing him of flirting with her 13-year-old cousin.
Sister or something. Yeah, cousin, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, it's quite, it didn't need to be in the film. It's like, why are you doing that? And it's like this sort of double bluff game that a lot of these figures did.
I know, well, Jimmy Savile did that loads too.
Yeah.
Like, would publicly like say on record.
I'm a pervert,
stuff.
You know.
Yeah.
And it throws people.
Benny Hill the other day come up on some YouTube deep dive on something. I watched it for a bit and I thought, this is so shocking that these old men are running around parks chasing girls and raping them, basically, and it's comedy.
Yeah.
And I was like, this was on TV. This was family entertainment.
It was so massive.
It was the
most popular show.
But that just shows you the cultural shift in the way that hopefully things are starting to improve. But I mean, I don't know. It's devastating, really. But I also find that really interesting. If you think of Rebecca, like Self-Esteem's album, you think of Lindsay's next show, which is looking at like women in history and how for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, women have been cancelled, women have been held back, you know, all these kind of. But I feel like it's interesting, the three of you, four of you, like there's a gang of you here, all the conversations you're having and how it's all pushing each of you onwards in your own direction. It's really cool.
Yeah, this sort of radical honesty that we all try and achieve.
And push each other to explore more.
Yeah.
Like, it's really cool.
Yeah, that kind of idea of like, no, go further. You could make a kind of really glib statement, but why don't you make a really difficult, complicated, or put forward a complicated idea that we don't know the answer to. You know,
exactly.
It's brilliant. Well, before we get into our final questions, I've got one really serious question to ask you. You are now a dog owner.
Yes.
And has that affected your work in any way? And can we talk about Telly, your pug?
I mean, it affected my life a lot because it's like, turns out dogs are quite time consuming.
Oh, yeah.
They're quite hard work to look after.
They're a privilege to be burdened with.
Yes. Yeah. I'm madly in love with him. We both are. He's wonderful. He's prize winning as well.
That's right. On the dog show recently here.
Yes, Cliftonville Dog Show. He won Best Dressed Dog.
I was so there. Many people, I'm witness.
So
to
many
this.
People were competing for that prize.
I was the documentary maker that day. Yeah. I made loads of films.
He had three heads, didn't he, for that
yeah,
prize?
The costume was a work of art.
It was like horror meets beauty. It was kind of like had three really heads. Interesting dynamic there.
Very American Horror Story style. And Lindsay's mum's an amazing sewer. And
so funny.
Yeah, she made the outfit with Lindsay's brief. And it was
Telly's just the sweetest dog as well. He's the kindest little energy.
Desperate.
He looks at you and he's just got this genuinely kind soul. He's really strange little angel.
He's very friendly. Yeah,
you two are very kind. I always think you know, pets mimic their parents.
That's true.
I think you two have a very kind, open, generous energy. So
thank you.
Any documentaries in the making about your dog?
We've already talked about possibly doing portraits. Like that could be our collaborative
love
venture.
This.
Yeah.
Please do that.
What your career's been building towards,
yes!
Guy.
This is what we've all been waiting for.
Well, actually, I used to use my cat a lot in my work, and there's a film I made about sort of about ghosts, actually, and I feature my dead. I kind of create a conversation with myself talking to my dead cat, Boddington.
Boddington.
I'll show you that. Songs of Eternal Praise, this film I made, all about kind of death and moving image. Because I've got an old video of him sitting by his food bowl and I kind of superimposed it into the film with me talking to him.
Wow.
It was a bit of a tearjerker.
I believe Telly is a work of art, so I'm really excited to see him in art. So we ask every guest two questions. The first is, if you could do an art heist and take home any artwork or I don't know, even a building or anything that you like, maybe a cinema that you like, what would you take home?
Well, this is tricky for me, triggering, because I was a security guard at a museum for 10 years. So, you know, the idea of an art heist is...
Where was it? National Gallery?
At the National Gallery, yes.
This is how you was able to film the ambassadors then?
Yeah,
the
hotline. That was actually me. I got a friend to film as if, because at the time there was no photography allowed. So yeah,
and you were actually a security guard on that day.
That was in the room.
In the film, thinking you're a security guard saying stop filming.
Yep. Yeah. Genius. Yeah. Very meta.
Genius. It's very meta. Yes. So you got to steal something.
Yeah, we're forcing you.
Okay. Well, I'd steal something from National Gallery. It would be it's a small portrait by Anthony van Dyck, and it's called Portrait of Cornelius van der Geest. Mm. And it's a really sort of tight close-up of an old man with a ruff. And it's just the most astonishing act of painting. It's phenomenal. It's so alive. It's just, particularly through these kind of highlights, you know, kind of white highlights of just glistening eyeball and, you know, moisture on his lip. And it's really sad, kind of like it's warts and all kind of portrait, but it's just phenomenal. And Glenn Brown did a version of it, where he's kind of, you know, through his sort of style. And it's, that would be, and it's quite small, so it could
You'd know the routes out of there, I'm sure.
Easy to put in your pocket.
Exactly.
And as a security guard, would you be allowed to go and sort of hang out in front of the artworks, or was you always assigned to a zone?
No, thank God. I did every corner of that gallery. Yeah. If I was just one room forever.
Get a bit repetitive after 10 years.
It was plenty repetitive anyway. I'm kind of like sick of those paintings, even though it's the greatest art collection in the world.
Yeah.
I know it all too well.
What is your favourite colour and why?
I always think of one of my old tutors, Tim Allen, who's a great abstract painter. And his response to that question was, it's a terrible question. And it's only he would only answer it in terms of combinations of colours.
Okay.
Because I suppose in real life, colours aren't in isolation. But saying that, I'll go for purple.
Oh, right. After all of that.
Purple and yellow.
Purple and yellow.
Not together.
Yeah, I just think they're a really kind of sexy combo.
Oh, nice.
But purple. I remember a few years ago, I noticed like a lot of my artworks ended up being purple, like unconsciously, and quite a few items of clothing. And so I realized like purple was maybe a thing for me.
What's the best advice you've ever received in regard to your art?
I remember actually Grayson Perry giving a talk, a piece of advice that's stuck with me, I thought was bang on. He said, don't be precious about opportunities that you take, just kind of take them all if you can. like when you're kind of starting out. Because I remember, you know, I know of a lot of students who kind of fuss over like, oh, should I go with this gallery or should I show here? It's like, no, just like get yourself out there, get your work out there, work hard. And yeah, things can happen from the most unexpected places.
Yeah.
And yeah, don't be too precious. Don't be too pretentious as well.
Yeah, unexpected, you know, job opportunities, absolutely. I did, I was on the Great British Bake Off. I did Extra Slice with Joe Brand. And there was a director called Joe Mantello who was directing a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf from Broadway, which got shut down during a pandemic and I don't think will ever come back. But I ended up being in that production because he was in London. He directed Wicked, the musical originally, and he was here doing notes on that. And he was in his hotel room watching Extra Slice, Great British Bake Off, reality TV, and went, oh, Russell Tovey, he'd be really good for Nick. Rung up the producer, and then I was suddenly on Broadway on the back of doing Extra Slice. So you never know, Guy.
Exactly.
And so listeners,
keep
always
open, everybody. Take those opportunities or make them. Exactly. Guy, also, I think the listeners need to know that your party trick is that you can ask you any year. Sorry, I can tell you the name of a film and you will tell me who directed it and what year it was made.
Well, you have caught me out on this, Rob. You were very pleased when you caught me out.
Because I asked him one and he got it wrong, but I was being quite obscure.
Batteries I think, not included.
Oh, man. Well, Steven Spielberg produced it. It was came out in 1988. Who directed that? I think you might have to Google it, but I think it was Joe Johnston.
Was it?
I've got no idea. The one that I caught,
Flight of the Navigator.
You're going for a very specific time period. That was made in 1986. You got me.
Oh, damn it.
Maybe a kind of, you know.
You normally get them all right. And the only one you didn't get right was Who's Eating Gilbert Grape? No, what was it? It wasn't that one. It was another one. Oh, do that one then.
That's Lassie Hallström, 1993.
Love that.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves with Kevin Costner.
Kevin Reynolds was the director, and that came out in 1990.
I know what it was. It was Benny and June, which no one saw anyway. So, I mean, that was too hard. It was just my favourite film.
1993 came out, Johnny Depp. But
love it.
I don't know the joke.
Well, anyway, Guy, it's been such a joy
brilliant
to have you on TalkArt. Everybody go online and you can see his films, but hopefully you'll also get to see them in an exhibition context because they're really, really brilliant and you really must watch them from start to finish because they're extraordinary.
We've been recording this in Rob's house. If you hear anything in the background...
Yeah, sorry about that.
Renovations.
Just like renovations happening.
Renovations.
Repairs, actually, not renovations.
Repairs. Okay.
Repairs. Thank you so much for joining us, Guy. And
thank you.
Are you on Instagram?
I am. It's Guy J. Oliver.
And you have a website as well?
I do, yeah. GuyOliver.co.uk.
Brilliant.
Right. And then we'll check out your forthcoming show when that gets announced. We will put that all in the blurb so people can go and see your
new I can't
piece.
Wait to see
and
the
we
film
can't wait
about
to see
scoliosis and your teen years.
Absolutely.
It sounds like your most personal project yet, so I'm very excited. Yeah. Well, on that note, we will be back very soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to TalkArt with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to TalkArt at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.